Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Can you be a Christian who supports abortion? Can you be a Christian who believes in Roe versus Wade? To me, that kind of sounds like being a member of the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, and also running a barbecue in your spare time. The two seem to conflict with one another, don't they? Seems to be that way for me, but other people disagree, and that's what we're going to get into here on the show today. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I am your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, and today I wanted to address one of the articles. I had alluded to it a few weeks ago when I said that there were people who I wanted to have on the podcast to talk about Roe versus Wade and recent abortion bans, and I wanted them to come on from a differing perspective, from a pro-choice perspective. We've already had one conversation with a pro-choice advocate, our very first non-Catholic dialogue here on the podcast, and I thought it went very well. That's one I've been sending to people to show them, hey, you can come on my show. It's a fair conversation. I treat my guests with civility. This isn't talking head, cable news, explode and yell at each other. We want to have a civil, if yet vigorous, conversation. I've sent out invitations, one tentative reply, but others when ignored. And if that's the case, then I'm still going to critique the material that's out there. The author just doesn't have the opportunity to be here in real time to have a discussion with me. So I've done the best that I can. One of those pieces I wanted to address was in the New York Times on May 30th, so a few weeks ago, was this opinion piece. I was an anti-abortion crusader. Now I support Roe versus Wade. Overturning the Supreme Court's 1973 decision would not be pro-life. It would be destructive of life. Now, I expect this kind of rhetoric from somebody who works, you know, the idea of saying that overturning Roe v. Wade is not pro-life. I would expect that from somebody who works at Planned Parenthood. I would expect that from someone who works at even, you know, Catholics for Choice. But I don't expect that from somebody who has been involved in the pro-life movement for decades, as part of a family that's been involved in the pro-life movement for decades. And that's what shocked me to see this was by Rob Schenck. Then I did more reading to see the whole picture and how it came to be. So before I get into the article, though, I just want to thank our subscribers. I want to have these dialogues in the future. And to do them, your support of the podcast makes it possible at trenthornpodcast.com. And also, if you want to bulk up your ability, your pro-life apologetics, if you want to be able to have good points to raise and a roadmap in conversations on abortion, especially on social media or with friends and family, get my new Trent Tracks. They're available at catholic.com. They're available for purchase at shop.catholic.com. Just search for Trent Tracks, T-R-E-N-T-T-R-A-X. Or if you are a silver member to the podcast, you get all the Trent Tracks I will be making in the future. In fact, I'm creating one now that's going to be on a Catholic guide to LGBTQ issues as we round out Pride Month. So if you're a silver member, $10 a month or more, you get every Trent Track I will ever do in perpetuity for free to you because you're a member. You'll have access to that and other great kinds of bonus content like our study series. So let's hop in, though, to this article. So who is Rob Schenck? So Rob Schenck, this is what I was confused about. When I heard that Rob Schenck was now pro-choice and not pro-life, I said he's been involved in pro-life stuff for decades. He was even in a famous Supreme Court case I was familiar with that had struck down floating buffer zone laws. These were laws and ordinances that prevented sidewalk counselors and pro-lifers from going and talking to women who were thinking of going into abortion facilities. And so the idea here was not just that you can't go within 10 feet of the door, that's a fixed buffer zone, but floating means if someone's walking from a parking lot or down the street, walking up to an abortion facility, you're not allowed to come near them and talk to them. You can't even have a conversation with someone on a public sidewalk. You could be arrested. So this went to the Supreme Court in Schenck versus Pro-Choice Network of Western New York. And Schenck, I thought the Schenck here was Rob Schenck, but it's actually Paul Schenck. Paul and Rob Schenck are identical twin brothers. They both grew up in a non-Catholic Christian family. Rob Schenck is now an evangelical minister. He's the president of the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Institute in Washington. Rob is the brother that is now pro-choice. Paul, as far as I'm aware, Paul Schenck is now a Catholic priest, and he is very pro-life. And so so definitely the brothers took very different paths here in that regard. So Rob recently, Rob Shank, Reverend Shank, well, I guess they're both reverends, but I'm just going to say Rob Shank. I don't think that's a problem. He was opposed to abortion. He was involved, I think, in the rescue movement. He was arrested several times, ended up in jail. And that shows up in the article, the editorial he wrote. And so I'm always amazed when I meet the, I guess I call them the Mavericks. A lot of people say, you know, who are the toughest people you go up against when it comes to apologists? A lot of counter-apologists, like people who are apologists for atheism or apologists for Protestantism or even among pro-choice advocacy. I meet a lot of people that are, I call them mavericks. You know, they were once apologists themselves. They were once people who did just what I did, and then they turn and they act in the same way, but they argue and operate for an entire the opposing belief system. Now, in some cases, that can be a good thing. St. Paul is a maverick by my definition. He was a Pharisee. He persecuted Christians, and then he became a Christian and did a 180 on exactly what he was doing. So sometimes God can do that to people. He can take people who are completely opposed to the faith and then turn them around to be the faith's greatest defenders. But then I guess Satan does the reverse. He can take people that are the greatest defenders of the faith and turn them into some of its greatest opponents. So one has to be careful. It reminds me of the quote from Friedrich Nietzsche. You know, how could this happen to somebody? It's a quote from Nietzsche. I forget where it's from, but he said, "Those who fight monsters must take steps to ensure they don't become monsters. Those who fight monsters must take steps to ensure they don't become monsters." Now, I'm not saying Mr. Rob Shank is a monster or anything like that, but what I'm saying is that when you have to fight evil on a day-to-day basis, when you're combating heresy, lies, deception, and you're going up against people who will pull any dirty trick in the book against you, it wears on your psyche. It's a spiritual battle. And we have to understand that we must resort to spiritual reserves and armaments, prayer, the sacraments, community support. If we don't have that, we can easily fall away. And that's what I see here in this piece in the New York Times by Rob Shank. So let me go through it and offer some commentary. He begins, "For more than 30 years, I worked to overturn Roe v. Wade. As an evangelical minister, I was deeply engaged in the world of the religious right, beginning with my vote for Ronald Reagan for president in 1980. So he goes on, he talks about his anti-abortion credentials going through the 90s, through the Clinton administration. Then he says, "Given my history, you might think I would be thrilled at the perilous threshold at which Roe now stands, following the passage of sweeping new abortion restrictions in such states as Alabama, Georgia, and Missouri. I'm not. Over the last decade, I have changed my view on Roe. I've come to believe that overturning Roe would not be pro-life. Rather, it would be destructive of life." And you know what? If somebody is going to abandon the pro-life cause or they're going to abandon the Christian faith, at the very least, I have respect for people who have engaged the most sophisticated arguments and have been deceived by other counter-arguments. If someone said, "You know what, I don't think the unborn is a human person anymore. Here is my argument. I've read this. I've read Patrick Leahy, Frank Beckwith, and I'm not convinced." And I might say, you know, they're mistaken, but they're trying to follow their conscience and they've tried to think their way through this. They've just thought to an erroneous conclusion. But the reasons that Shank gives, it boggles my mind, as you will see. So why would overturning Roe be destructive of life? "I have witnessed firsthand and now appreciate the full significance of the terrible poverty, social marginalization, and bald-faced racism that persists in many of the states whose legislators are now essentially banning abortion. If Roe is overturned, middle and upper-class white women will still secure access to abortions by traveling to states where abortion is not banned. But members of minorities and poor whites will too often find themselves forced to bear children for whom they cannot adequately care." First, I love how this is kind of racist here. I just noticed this. He says, upper middle-class white women, but minorities and poor whites will find themselves forced to bear children. As if it is completely impossible in these situations, completely impossible for a member of a minority community to be economically stable. That's because he says here, you know, minorities and poor whites. So the rich whites will be fine, but not the poor whites and the minorities who are all poor. Now, I agree, there is more poverty among minority communities, and there's various reasons for that. But just to lump everyone together into a helpless class, to me, that has a tinge of racism to it. And then this argument, this is what boggles my mind. And I think it has to reveal for Rob Shank a kind of naivety he must have had. I would ask, when you were doing pro-life work from 1980 until the mid-2000s, for 20, 25 years, 30 years, what did you say when people told you, I think poor people are going to need abortions? What did you tell them? Did you not find out about poverty until a few, I think he became pro-choice like a few years ago. And I've seen this with other evangelical Christians, and even among Catholics, that sometimes they get older and on in their years, and they kind of take this hard left turn, and suddenly they're not thinking with their heads anymore, and they're just thinking with this kind of sentimentality wrapped up in compassionate language. I wrote a blog about this on Camo not too long ago. I said it was, Jesus is not the property of liberal commentators. Let's see, because it was Schaefer. I want to say it's Frank Schaefer. I said, Jesus, I want to say, see, this is what happens when you try to Google on the fly. But Frank Schaefer was the son of a well-known conservative evangelical scholar, Frank Schaefer. I think it's Frankie Schaefer. He did the same thing. He did a hard left turn and became very liberal in his politics, pro-choice, pro-LGBT. And it's sad. It's sad to see something like that. But I would ask, Rob Shank, you know, did you not know about poverty? How does this change your argument? Otherwise, it just shows to me that your pro-life convictions either must have been very, very weak, or you were just hopelessly naive about the world. But people will come to me. I remember once, if you look on YouTube, Trent Horn, UNM 2009 open microphone. There's clips of me doing the open microphone at University of New Mexico. And there's this girl who comes up, and she is just the poster child for millennials, like trying to, with this hubris, telling me, I'm out defending the unborn in front of a graphic exhibit. And she says, not every woman has it easy. Some people are on welfare. Some people are poor. Did you ever think about that? As if I've never thought about poverty. As if I was never the one in middle school who had the reduced lunch ticket and was grateful that my lunch only cost 40 cents and, you know, we were able to get by with that. No, I've never heard about poverty, lady. There's welfare? What's welfare? I've never heard of that at all. This idea that, of course, there are some wealthy people who are completely detached from everyday life, who don't really understand poverty. And I don't understand poverty in the same way that someone who is walking in well-worn out shoes and has the stresses of poverty, I don't understand it as intimately as them, but I am certainly familiar with it. I have compassion for those who are experiencing economic difficulties, but what I will not do is justify killing and hurting other people to alleviate poverty. Just because someone's in poverty, that doesn't give them the right to rob a bank or rob a store just for money. Now, obviously, if there's a hurricane disaster situation, you have to get bread at an abandoned grocery store, that's different. St. Thomas Aquinas even talks about that. That's the case of acquiring goods out of necessity. But you don't have the right in a hurricane or a disaster situation to loot Best Buy and get any big screen TV you want. That's not how it works. But so the point is that, yes, of course, poverty is a difficult situation, but it doesn't justify evils. You don't have the right to kill somebody so you can get the job that they're going to get, so you can get their job and lift yourself up out of poverty. So Shank is right that if you outlaw abortion, it will create some inequalities. Rich people will be able to get abortions more than poor people. But guess what? Rich people are able to get away with crimes more than poor people. Inequality is only a problem when there is a good that is being unjustly denied to others. It's not wrong to make access to evil unequal for people. That if you can keep lots of people from accessing evil, if they turn out to be poor or marginalized members of society, that's okay, because it's not good for those people to access evil in the first place. You want genuinely what is their good. If Rob Shank cares about the poor, why would he advocate an evil for them? And just spoiler alert, this whole article, he never once talks about the baby. He never once says the baby's not a baby, the unborn child is not a human being. So he's just arguing from this kind of a crude pragmatism. He goes up, but I want to address that because there's a lot of assumptions we don't break down in articles like these. He says, what is pro-life about putting a woman in a situation where she must risk pregnancy without proper medical, social, and emotional support? I want to do a hard stop right there, a Zach Morris timeout. This comes up a lot, that when a pro-lifer wants to outlaw abortion, wants to protect the right to life of an unborn child, people say, we are putting women in difficult situations. No, we're not. We're not doing that at all. The people who put themselves in these difficult situations are 100% of the time men and 98.5% of the time women. So obviously there are cases where if a woman is a victim of rape or incest, she is in a difficult situation through no fault of her own, obviously. But in the vast majority of cases, it is men and women who are making free choices with their bodies that they know can lead to the conception of a child, who act irresponsibly, and then a child comes into existence. That, and we'll talk about this more as I go through the success sequence and its critics. What's the success sequence? I shall tell you. But there's a common divide in the world today that when bad things happen, when someone does something wrong, either they are morally responsible for their actions, or they're not morally responsible and they're shaped by society. They can't help it. They live in a social structure that leads to them being in a unintended pregnancy or a difficult situation. Now, I'm not advocating for one or the other. As I'll explain later, there's a mixture of being in social structures that can guide you and bias you in a way towards bad decisions, but you still, ultimately, as a human being, you have free will and you have free choices. So I can't stand that when people put here saying that pro-lifers put people in situations. We don't put, no pro-lifer puts someone in any social situation. We are just saying that when you are in that social situation, it should be illegal for you to kill another human being in order to get out of it. And so somehow we are the ones who are the bad guys here. He goes on to say, what is pro-life about forcing the birth of a child if that child will enter a world of rejection, deprivation, and insecurity, to say nothing of the fear, anxiety, and danger that comes with poverty, crime, and a lack of educational and employment opportunities? Well, by this logic, Reverend Shank, you agree there are lots of children who experience fear, anxiety, and danger and are in difficult situations. Let's just kill them. Let's just kill them. Then they don't have to deal with it. Oh, wait, yeah, because killing human beings is wrong. Well, why is it wrong? You can't kill people. What are the unborn? We're right back. That's classic pro-life 101 that someone who had been involved in the pro-life movement for 30 years, 40 years, should know about. And so it boggles my mind that he just doesn't see that. So what I want to say is that when we put this out to people, we should not fall into the trap of thinking that unintended pregnancy is some kind of disease that people catch in the air, like the Spanish flu or H1N1. You know, this is not something that just happens to people. It's a result of people's behaviors. It's a result that we have to take responsibility for our actions, and that's not a bad thing to say. What are pro-lifers doing? Who puts themselves in these situations? That's why I want to talk about something called the success sequence. This is something that has been talked about in the early 90s among sociologists. Bradford Wilcox released a study in 2017 looking at millennials and their life choices and whether that leads to being in poverty or not. And so the success sequence goes like this. People who graduate from high school, work full-time, and wait to have children until after they are married and have turned 21 are very, very unlikely to end up in poverty. According to Wilcox, young men and women from less advantaged backgrounds who missed steps 1 through 2, which is graduating high school and working full time, are about twice as likely to be poor. And those who missed all 3 steps, so if you dropped out of high school, you didn't get a job, full-time at least, and you had children outside of marriage, he says they were 6 times as likely to be poor compared to their peers from lower income or minority backgrounds who are living in accord with the sequence. So that's the idea of the success sequence. How do you stay out of poverty? And what social scientists have found over decades of research is that if you graduate from high school, work full-time, and wait to have children until after marriage, and especially after turning 21, then you're very, very unlikely to end up in poverty. I think Wilcox says something like people, less than 9% of people from disadvantaged backgrounds end up in poverty when they follow this sequence. However, the sequence has a lot of controversy to it. A writer from The Atlantic says, the success sequence, trustworthy as it may sound, conveniently frames structural inequalities as matters of individual choice. And so that's what I read critics of the success sequence. What they'll say is, no, people who are, it's correlation, not causation. They'll say it's not graduating high school, working full time and waiting to have kids that makes you successful. Rather, it's successful people who were born into ideal circumstances will end up graduating high school, working full time and waiting to have kids. It's the cart before the horse problem. But Wilcox and his co-author control for that in his study. They do a control at race, intelligence, based on people taking an IQ test, looking at family structures, divorce, poverty rates, geography. When all of that is controlled for, that people from equally disadvantaged backgrounds, those who follow the success sequence, will be far less likely to be in poverty than those who do not. So, and I think that the reason I bring this up is that when people throw this out and say there's poverty and people who can't care for their children and pro-lifers, it's your fault. How is it my fault? I'm just saying they shouldn't end the lives of an unborn child. We should all work together to end poverty. But many pro-lifers would put forward, hey, how about we teach people and encourage them and motivate them and work together with them to make good, healthy choices in life? Why wouldn't we do that? Now, there is a bit of a point here in the criticisms. There's a bit of a point in criticism, and that's why, for those who would agree with me more on these issues, sometimes when you read about things like the success sequence, we take a far too monolithic approach to poverty. And so we'll say, oh, those people who are poor, that's their own problem. They didn't follow the success sequence. That's their problem. I'm not going to help them. Look, the fact of the matter is, even if somebody makes a colossally stupid mistake in life, they're still a human being made in the image and likeness of God. And so we ought to help them. We all, you and I, have made colossally big mistakes in life. And I'm sure we are grateful that other people helped us to get out of the mistakes that we made. So just because someone's made a mistake doesn't mean you can just abandon them to their folly. But it's also the case that many times, this is not a guarantee. Even Wilcox showed that 10% of even a small portion of individuals, there's going to be, the 9% figure is what I'm thinking of. That's still 1 out of 10 people in a disadvantaged background who follow the sequence will still be in poverty. Poverty can be a difficult thing to escape if you have structural forces that keep you from escaping it. And in the past, it was far worse because we had racial segregation laws. We had overt racism that was not illegal. Even before that, we had slavery. So things have gotten better. It's so funny to me that on a college campus, if I were to say, America is far better now, racial relations have improved over the past 60 years. Or I might say racial relations are at their best in the United States at this moment. People would, in some universities, would become apoplectic they would just be triggered. I talked about triggering on my social media posts, I think last week. But it was demonstrably true. When you compare what Martin Luther King Jr. and civil rights activists had to deal with in the 1950s and 60s and what we have today, It has gotten better, but there's still lingering effects of structural inequality and racism. And the fact of the matter is that for people who are poor, we have to accept that if you live in a neighborhood where there's crime, where there's violence, where there's poor police protection, if you don't feel safe walking to school, if you don't feel safe being able to go to your job, you don't feel safe being in your home, then you can be trapped in poverty. That's why one of my favorite books on poverty actually is called The Locus Effect. So the book is called The Locus Effect. It's by, Gary Haugen. And the point he makes is this, this is a review in Slate Magazine. The principal cause of misery and stagnation in the world isn't a lack of food or education. It's violence and lawlessness. In the United States, crime has sunk to historic lows, but across much of the globe, it's rampant. The crisis isn't just war. Haugen calls everyday violence, sex crime, slavery, and theft. Based on World Health Organization data, Haugen says sexual violence and domestic violence cause more death and disability among women from age 14 to 44 than war, malaria, and car accidents combined. In Peru, he recalls a doctor reported seeing 50 cases of rape in the preceding 5 days. All the victims were less than 15 years old. And sometimes we think, well, why are people poor? And we think it's just because they don't have resources. So we think, well, give them resources. Why is someone poor in this developing country? We need to send resources over to them. Oftentimes, though, people are poor not because they don't have stuff, but because they don't have a secure place to hang on to their stuff. Even if you give them stuff, other people, whether it's neighbors, lawless citizens, or the government itself, if it's a kleptocracy, a government that steals from its own citizens, will take it from them. And so that's why one of the best ways to fight poverty is to ensure lawfulness and public order of the common good. That's why it boggles my mind. I was just reading an article today that Sacramento, their LGBT pride parade, at first would not let police officers march in uniform. It was just so funny. You're supposed to be open and inclusive, right? But they say, well, police officers are triggering to our community. And so this is the same. Then now they've reversed that. But in Portland and Berkeley, California, they have a shortage of police officers. People don't want to be police because police officers are often blamed and attacked unjustly when they're trying to uphold the law, especially in the face of Antifa protesters who, like mobs, will take over downtown. Antifa has taken over parts of Portland, and the mayor lets them and has even praised some of their actions. So if you denigrate law enforcement, people don't want to be police officers. And if you don't have solid law enforcement, especially in many impoverished areas of the United States, then you have crime, which leads to poverty and instability. So the point I wanted to make here, and Wilcox makes this point himself. Wilcox is not ignorant of this. In the study on the success sequence, he says, young adults from poor neighborhoods, bad schools, and less educated families are going to have fewer opportunities to flourish in school, work, and the marriage market. But on the Cato Journal, Cato is a kind of a libertarian think tank. They had a journal debating the success sequence a while back. One of the entries by Michael Tanner I really enjoy. It's that he agrees. He says, look, we have to look at some of these other structural factors. But I appreciate that while he brings up the structural factors, he doesn't sugarcoat the issue of individual responsibility. He says this: one cannot assume that the poor are simply chaff blown by the wind, hapless and passive in the face of circumstances beyond their control. Nor can one deny them responsibility for their choices. To do so devalues the poor and treats them as less than fully human. So I think that's important. Then when people, so to come back to the Shank article, people will say, people are poor, they need abortion. You pro-lifers, you're not helping them enough. You're forcing them into these difficult situations. No, I'm sorry. We're not forcing anybody to be in any difficult situation. We're just saying they can't kill another human being to get out of that difficult situation. People many times, not all the time, but many times find themselves in difficult situations because they've made very poor life choices. That does not absolve us of our responsibility to help people in difficult situations, however. But don't pin it on us. And also, don't say that we don't help the poor. Don't say that we don't help, we don't want to provide for them. He's going forward a little bit in the article. He says, I'd like to think that the churches and pro-life organizations I worked with for those 30 years would provide the necessary tens of millions of dollars, thousands of volunteer hours, social services, medical and dental care, educational support, food, clothing, and spiritual assistance. But I suspect, frankly, I know that they cannot or will not. Will not? I would like to see some evidence here from Reverend Shank saying that, you know, some pro-lifers absolutely refuse to help the poor in any way, shape, or form. Now, many pro-lifers are convinced that government programs to help the poor are a waste of money, and a lot of that money gets funneled into bureaucracies. I've seen that here in California. Right now, I'm worried about taking my children up to Los Angeles. I'd love to take them to Disneyland at some point, but I just found out that Los Angeles might have the bubonic plague. Which, if you don't know how bad the bubonic plague is, go back to my Free For All Friday where I talked about the Black Death. That's right, the same thing, the bubonic plague in homeless camps in Los Angeles, which have increased by 16%, even though you have a Democratic supermajority here in California. You might say, well, that's what Reverend Shank and a lot of people seem to say. If you're pro-life, why don't you vote for these liberal social programs? Well, in many cases, maybe they don't work. Or we can have reasonable disagreements about whether they work or not, but we can't reasonably disagree on the morality of ending a child's life in order to try to alleviate poverty. So there's a great article I remember back in 2011 on publicdiscourse.com, the Public Discourse, by Helen Alvarez, who's a wonderful pro-life thinker. And the article is called The Lazy Slander of the Pro-Life Movement. That's what I see, and it's especially hard to see from someone like Rob Shank, who used to be in the movement for 30 years. You'll hear this all the time. People will tell you, pro-lifers only care about life after it's born. You tell them, that is not true. That is a very harsh thing to say. Where's your evidence for that? And the evidence will usually be, well, you don't want to vote for my politicians who support these government welfare programs. And in fact, that's not the case. Marco Rubio, for example, supports paid family leave. Many members of the Republican Party support paid family leave. Of course, Republicans and Democrats differ about how to alleviate poverty. But just because I disagree with you about your solution for alleviating poverty doesn't mean I don't care about the poor. Doesn't mean you don't care. And you, might, you, the listener, may disagree with me about politics. That is totally fine. Catholics can reasonably disagree with one another about these prudential matters. I cover that in my book, actually, Counterfeit Christ, in the section on prudential judgment, when people say Jesus would definitely vote for my political platform. Check it out at the end of the book there. But it is slander to say pro-lifers don't care about life after birth, because they do. They do, and they choose to help people. They choose to help babies after they're born and their mothers through ways that they think are the most effective. So here's what Alvarez says. She talks about how the Catholic Church is the largest financial institution. The Catholic Church, perhaps the single most influential pro-life institution in the United States, makes the largest financial, institutional, and personal commitments to charitable causes of any private source in the United States. These include AIDS ministry, healthcare, education, housing services, and care for the elderly, disabled, and immigrants. In 2007, the Catholic Campaign for Human Development awarded $9 million in grants to reduce poverty. And in 2009, the Catholic Legal Immigration Network spent nearly $5 million in services for impoverished immigrants. She goes on to say the Catholic Church is far from the only pro-life religious group that assists the needy. At the Manhattan Bible Church, a pro-life church in New York since 1973, Pastor Bill Devlin and his congregation run a soup kitchen that has served over 1 million people and a K-8 school that has educated 90,000 needy students. Pastor Devlin and other church families have adopted scores of babies and taken in scores of pregnant women, including some who are both drug addicted and HIV positive. The church runs a 150-bed residential drug rehabilitation center and a prison ministry at Rikers Island. All told, the church runs some 40 ministries, and all without a government dime. And then Alvarez goes on to make the killer point, pun intended, I guess. No major pro-abortion group or institution has taken on a comparable commitment to vulnerable Americans. Yeah, you don't see Planned Parenthood, you don't see NARAL doing this kind of work for the poor. It's pro-lifers. So I think what's funny is people, when poverty occurs, especially among those who find themselves with an unintended pregnancy, people point to pro-lifers and say, hey, what are you doing about all of this? And I could say, hey, wait a minute, shouldn't we all be dealing with poverty among born people? We all agree they're people. Why is it only the responsibility of pro-lifers? Because we're the ones who say that they can't end the lives of their unborn children? That it would be like saying it's demanding that pro-lifers solve these problems is like saying, hey, you firefighters, why aren't you finding housing for all of these people who you rescue from these burning buildings? You're going to go in there, you're going to rescue these people from these burning buildings. Who's going to house them? Who's going to feed them? Who's going to take care of them? Firefighter would say in response, rightfully, are you tripping? One, that's not my responsibility. And two, people are on fire. I have to go in there and save them. We'll figure it out later how to house and feed and care for them, but it's not my responsibility. My responsibility is to get the people out of the burning building. So for pro-lifers, our primary responsibility is to keep kids from being dismembered by abortion. But we go above and beyond that in so many cases that other people refuse to recognize, and I believe sometimes disingenuously so, to help those who have chosen to not end their child's life, to make future good, helpful choices for them and for their children. So when people tell you pro-lifers don't care about born people, ask them to prove that. And if they just cite their politics, say, can't we disagree about politics, but still both be equally committed to helping human beings? And if we are committed to helping human beings, then shouldn't we protect all human beings under the law? Because if you want to reduce poverty, you need to make sure everyone is protected under the law and that they feel safe in society. At the very least, they should be safe in the womb. I hope this is helpful for you. Get my new Trent Tracks at shop.catholic.com on abortion. And I hope that you guys have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.